So this is week three here on this subject, and I want to do just a quick review of where we have been. Back in July, we kind of started this by looking at the Bible's position on wine and alcohol and getting that straight in the first place. And we observed that wine is a gift from God according to the Bible, and it's called good and it's called a blessing. But like anything else, this is a gift that can be misused. It can be abused. And so wine should never be used in a way that's outside of God's parameters. And we need to use it within the design if we use it at all. And we warned you then, and we continue to warn, especially want to warn young people against the abuse of alcohol. And that's not something that we take lightly, nor can we. 2 weeks ago, we came back to this subject, now specifically looking at wine in communion. And we asked, why is it that Aletheia uses grape juice instead of wine? And we found that the answer is not that it was a product of biblical study, like we had searched the scriptures. Rather, it was simply passed down to us. It was passed down, starting a tradition that began in the 1800s, and it was started by those who held a false view of God's creation, that it was evil. Paul had written to Timothy that this view is actually, and these are Paul's words, demonic, the idea that something God created is evil, and so demonic in its source, that is, and that everything that God created is good, and it is to be received with thanksgiving. So we looked at that history, and last week we looked at the question of why the elders believe that it is good to return to the historic practice of using wine in the Lord's Supper. And really, the real issue, the real question here is what is true and what is best. It's not what am I used to, or what is my tradition, or what do I like, or what's my preference. What's true and what is best? And so our reasons for moving forward with wine would be, first of all, that Jesus chose wine. And that we don't have a right to change the symbols that God chose. We don't have any more right to pick something better than Moses would have had a right to pick something better than the snake on the pole. We just don't have that prerogative. Of course, this reason is dependent on Jesus actually having served wine and instituted wine for us. And we looked at five reasons to believe that he did. First, the fruit of the vine, especially that phrase used in conjunction with Passover, was understood as a reference to wine. And that's the expression Jesus used, the fruit of the vine. So it had that context. Secondly, Jesus was celebrating the Passover for sure, and the Passover always used wine historically. Now, initially, they may not have, but it arose as a tradition, and then Jesus picked up on that tradition. Thirdly, grape juice was not available at that time of year because the Passover was in the spring. Grapes were harvested in the fall. Also, the apostles in the early church used wine. We saw the example of Corinth when some of the believers were getting drunk. Paul didn't say, hey, wait a minute, what are you guys doing? You're using wine? Jesus didn't use wine. He used grape juice. He didn't correct them that way. Instead, what he said was you need to exercise self-control. So he warned against excess. And then finally, the church through the ages never really questioned this until the 1800s. So we can be, I think, rather certain that Jesus did use wine. And it's one thing, I think, to say, well, I just don't believe that. I believe that Jesus served grape juice. I don't believe that position is tenable, although I've been challenged to give that a second look, and I will. But it's an entirely different thing to acknowledge that Jesus used wine, but we think grape juice is better. Now, that, I think, is a real problem. I think that is actually insulting to Christ in a way, calling into question his wisdom in choosing wine. The second reason is that the symbols that God chose are important to him, and he had reasons for choosing them because they communicate certain truths to us. Wine has representation. It means something. It's connected with certain things. Among those things, blessing and favor in the Old Testament, joy and celebration, value, and pointing ahead to the heavenly banquet. Thirdly, sticking to the rather modern tradition of grape juice in the Lord's Supper seems to affirm the Gnostic heresy that God's physical creation is evil in some sense, or at least aspects of it could be. And that seems like the last thing that we would want to give any credibility to. And finally, just truth over tradition. We want to be a church that's really anchored in truth, in the Word of God, not, boy, this is what we're used to, this is what we're comfortable with. We want to always yield to the truth, and I think it sets a dangerous precedent to take anything really in the Bible and tweak it and adjust it in ways that suit us. So this week, what we want to do is we had solicited your thoughts, your questions, your opinions and comments. And many of you replied to a questionnaire. And we want to respond to those questions and comments. I was actually delighted to see how many of you said to me, I have no idea how to fill out a questionnaire and send it back through email. That was actually really nice because I always feel like a Neanderthal in a technological age. And so thank you. I now feel like I have some company. But you figured it out. Some of you sent me texts and others called, and that was great. We appreciated all of that response, and we read those comments and questions and prayerfully, and we considered them. And so we're going to address them now, and I'm going to let Phil jump up here and start with some of those.
Are you going to do that one first or no?
Am I? Which one was I going to do? Oh, yeah, that's a good point. We really have our act together here. Yeah, why now? That's let me say something first, though. It was brought to my attention that maybe some of the way, I don't know if it's more tone or choice of words, might have been perceived as kind of maybe talking down a little bit to people who disagreed with me on this, and please know my heart on that. If I did that, I'm sorry. That was unintentional. I would not do that intentionally. I do a lot of bad things unintentionally, and just miss it. And so, if you felt like my comments were maybe a little too dogmatic or whatever, then I do apologize for that, and I hope you'll forgive me. The question, why now? Why now are we taking this up? You heard Phil's story, a little bit of it, last week, and I want to give you mine. We're going to address the issue of conscience a little later. And I want to say pastors have consciences too. And so I have had, for at least 13 or 14 years, a nagging conviction on this subject. It's been a long time, and just this nagging thing that eats at me and always has every time we celebrate communion, that we don't have a right to change the elements. We don't have, that's just not our right. And as a leader, as a pastor, it's bothered me continuously. And yet I knew that it would be something that would be controversial. And so I was torn between, I don't want to cause strife or any kind of disunity. And yet it just kept nagging at me to the point that it got to a point that I felt like I had to kind of press it a little bit with the elders. And so it would have been probably 8 months ago that we kind of took it up again. And that's when the elders said, yeah, we see that and we agree. And so that's why now we are taking this up. We also all agreed that it would be a good idea to take it slowly. And so that's why it's taken this long to try to figure out the best way to do that. And if you look at that and you say, well, Sean, I think that's silly. I think that you were bothered about nothing. It's okay for you to think that. But I do want to let you know that conviction that I had in my conscience was very real and very persistent for a long time. So, thank you.
I'll just say, too, we're not planning on celebrating communion today or next week. This is something that we kind of view as still in process. And so if you did not fill out your survey and would like to, or if you have other comments after today, we totally welcome those. We've already had some interaction with folks. We've gotten a lot of supportive feedback, also plenty of questions. We're going to deal with those this morning, as Sean mentioned. For example, what about kids? What about pregnant moms? What about recovering alcoholics? Those kind of things. We're going to deal with all those this morning, but there are admittedly some things that still would need to be ironed out. And so, but we don't view this as kind of like now is the start date and we still want this to be in process, and we do invite your feedback about anything really, not just about communion wine, about anything going on in the life of the church. Hopefully you know that we're not in an ivory tower somewhere. We live, right down the street kind of thing. So please feel free to bring those kinds of questions. One of the comments that people brought up was, would this be disunifying, for this to be kind of a controversy that's brought out into the light? And I love that people have that concern. That's a concern that's always before me. What can we do to guard the unity of our church? We want to be vigilant in protecting that. And so we are going to deal with that question. And that's certainly a goal here as we move forward in this issue is Ephesians 4:3 says, make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace. And we're doing that. I think there are probably a number of us here that would be like, oh, yeah, we could make the change next week. That wouldn't bother us. Probably others, some other people that are still uncomfortable with this. And that's OK. So we're going to, the goal is to build consensus and move forward together as one. 1 Corinthians 1:10, let there be no division among you. So that's the goal here, to go slow and deliberate and keep everybody together. Okay, the next question that we're going to respond to is, how much alcohol is in a communion cup of wine? So assuming we use the same cups, I don't have any reason to change the communion cups. How much alcohol are we actually talking about? And here, again, we're talking about normal red wine. Not the fanciest stuff, not the cheapest stuff either. Again, it's to be appropriate for celebrating a special occasion. The amount of alcohol in one of our communion cups with wine would be significantly less than the amount of alcohol in a single dose of cough syrup like NyQuil. And with NyQuil, you can take several doses in a 24-hour period. And so there's, again, significantly less alcohol in one communion cup per month than you would take if cough syrup in a single day if you were taking NyQuil. Most of us don't object to that small amount of alcohol used in medicine. It's, we see it as beneficial. There are cough syrups that are made without alcohol for people with allergies, or there's some other conditions that we'll kind of mention here, other situations that we'll mention. But the main answer here, how much alcohol, it's really negligible. It's a one sip of wine once per month. It's a very small amount. Several did ask about also that frequency of communion. How often really should we be taking communion? And the Bible is actually silent on that, how often communion is to be taken. In 1 Corinthians 11, it says, whenever you do this, it doesn't really give like how often it should be. There are some passages in Acts that talk about breaking of bread, and it's not clear whether that's talking about communion or whether it's just sharing a meal together. And even that is not consistent. Sometimes they're they're breaking bread together every day in the temple courts. Other times it's once per week on the first day of the week. That would be Sunday. But there's really no biblical imperative about the frequency of communion. Some churches do celebrate communion every Sunday. Some do once per month like us. Some do once per quarter. Some do once per year on the Passover. It's kind of like the fulfillment of that Old Testament practice of celebrating the Passover. So that's the answer on that one. Another question that was brought up was, will we be consistent and use unleavened bread? So switching to wine, seeking to be more faithful to what Jesus originally used, will we also use unleavened bread, which is we assume what Jesus used on the Passover. And the answer here is yes, we do intend to make that change also. Again, this one's comparatively not controversial. I don't think, even Christians, non-Christians, anybody in our culture, we tortillas, which is unleavened bread, and pita bread, which is unleavened. And so that's something that most people are going to be, comfortable with. Again, at the Last Supper, Jesus almost for sure would have used unleavened bread because it was for the Passover. Remember that some of the symbolism involved there with using unleavened bread. God commanded the Hebrews to use unleavened bread to show that they were leaving in haste, that there wasn't time to let the bread rise. They were to leave in haste. When, as soon as Pharaoh said, get out, then they were to leave and they didn't have time to let the dough rise. Later in the New Testament, Jesus warned about the yeast of the Pharisees, with yeast there symbolizing their sin, their false teaching. And so, again, the answer here is yes, that we will begin using unleavened bread. We've actually used unleavened bread in the past. That's not our habit as of late here, but that is an appropriate change, I think, also. Some other people asked about, do we need to, how much do we need to recreate that first Last Supper? Do we need to share a single cup? Do we need to do it as part of a meal? And I just think that some of those details are incidental. The things that Jesus deliberately chose would have been the bread and the wine. I don't know that we need to press for every detail. We don't need to celebrate communion in Jerusalem, in an upper room, wearing tunics, wearing sandals, not using electricity. I mean, you could kind of go crazy with that, I think. So I think there are some symbols that we should work towards keeping, but a lot of these kinds of things are incidental. And so the things that we want to, I think, insist on are the bread and the wine. I do think it would be cool when we've done that before, celebrated communion in the context of a full meal. I think that would be good to do again, but I don't know that it's necessary every time. I don't think it is. Okay, probably the most frequent question we got was, what about kids? And which, again, I think is great. We're concerned for everybody among us. One of the questions is it legal? And the answer to that is yes, it is legal for children to take communion wine. Obviously, it's illegal to serve alcohol to minors in other circumstances, but for religious celebration, that is allowed under the law. And we're not trailblazers in this. There are thousands of churches around the world that serve communion wine each Sunday, and of course, not only Christians taking communion wine, but also Jews using wine, children taking wine with Jewish celebrations for the Seder meal and that kind of thing. A couple things here. Alcohol is, of course, dangerous for children in the womb and for very young children. I was talking with Brooke Lange this week. She shared with me that the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends no alcohol for pregnant and nursing moms. And so, obviously, we don't serve communion to, Ellie doesn't come and take communion, and Jonah and Nora don't take communion. So we don't serve alcohol to young children. So that's something, again, some of these details is we still need to iron out. How will we handle that with pregnant moms, nursing moms? Obviously, we're not going to, force people to take wine that it wouldn't be healthy for them, that kind of thing. As children get older, they can have small amounts of alcohol without the danger of ill effects. Again, the amount of alcohol in communion wine is significantly less than even in a dose of cough syrup. So, okay, another question related to children is, does this set our kids and teenagers up for addiction? And the answer here is no. First, I'll just speak from my own perspective. Many of you know that I grew up in a Roman Catholic family. I was part of a Roman Catholic church until I was in college. And I took my first communion using communion wine in second grade. I was 7, I think, and took communion wine all the way up until I left the Catholic church when I was 18 or 19. And in no way was that a gateway alcohol experience, gateway drug. I did not drink socially in high school or in college, even as an unbeliever. I still have never, to this day, have never been drunk in my life. And so I don't, just again, anecdotally, that was not my experience, that I took communion wine and wanted more of that or wanted something else. And so it was unusual. I didn't have wine during my regular. I think I'd have a sip of my dad's wine at Thanksgiving or something from time to time. But wine, communion wine, was something that was kind of special. And I think that was a good thing, actually, looking back. Another thing to consider here is that there are a number of children, teenagers who grow up in churches where grape juice is served, and they still get into alcohol. So I don't think that the root issue is what did you have growing up for communion. And in fact, a lot of the articles, the studies that I've seen, what are the factors that cause students, teens, to get into alcohol and abuse alcohol? A lot of it has to do with how they saw their parents using alcohol. So I think if parents are using alcohol, like having a cup of wine at supper, like some European families, or taking wine for communion, I don't think that's, pushing our kids towards addiction. I think it's more if kids see their parents drinking socially. In another context, Jesus said that it's not what comes into your body that makes you sinful. It's what's in your hearts that comes out that makes you unclean. And so I think that's really the issue. What is it that makes people alcoholic or abuse alcohol? It's the sin in their hearts. It's not, their experience as a child at church or something like that. There are actually some statistics that seem to indicate that kids who grow up in religious communities that use wine frequently, for example, Jews, have lower levels of alcohol abuse and alcoholism. So I don't think that this is necessarily like we're pushing our kids to alcohol and more alcohol. I think, again, it's limited to this single application of celebrating communion wine as Jesus used wine in the first instance there. I'll just add, too, I actually think it's important for us to teach our kids. As you know, we're teaching worldview on Wednesdays with our teens. And I actually think this is a good, godly thing for parents to do is, I want my kids to see the whole world the way God does. And that's a loving thing. That's a loving aspect of discipleship. I want you to see the world the way that God does. I don't think God sees alcohol as evil. Again, alcohol is something that God created. So teaching our kids to think in line with biblical truth is actually a good thing. It might be easier as a parent to say, alcohol is evil, don't touch it, don't go near it, but I actually think that's maybe giving way to fear and not consistent with the overall biblical worldview. And so, again, that's just a way that we love our kids, is helping them to see the world in all of, every detail, including wine, as God sees it. So I do think that, again, we can be ruled by fear. It's like, well, I don't want my kid to be sexually immoral so he can't look at any women, or I don't want my kid to be a glutton so he can never have dessert, or he can never have seconds, or something like that. And I think that's maybe just living too much in fear, and we don't want to say these things are bad in and of themselves unless God says that. So anything you want to add on those? Go ahead.
I am you know that I don't actually drink, but I have family, my brother, who does, and he doesn't drink to excess, but he'll have an occasional beer here and there. And I'm actually, I know there are two ways to look at that. Some people would say, boy, I want to protect my children from that. I don't want them to see that, someone drinking beer, especially a Christian. But for me personally, I actually want my kids to see my brother drink a beer because Uncle Josh doesn't get drunk. Uncle Josh doesn't abuse this. And I think the world needs examples, particularly our young people, of use without abuse. Because sometimes I think we see it as either people get blitzed or they're completely abstinent and they have nothing to do with this thing that God created. But where is using this the way that God intended it? So a lot of young people, I think it's like, I grew up here, I saw this, I don't want that, I guess I go here. And so for me, I'm just thankful for that example. You can disagree with that. That's okay. But that's just my experience. Another question that came up several times is, What about alcoholics and ex-alcoholics among us? And I think sometimes we imagine that the problems that we face here in America in the 21st century are new to us, and that the ancients didn't experience those same problems. Ecclesiastes tells us, though, that there's nothing new under the sun. And what we call alcoholism was certainly present among ancient Christians. We know for sure that it was in Corinth. I want to read to you from 1 Corinthians 6, and you'll see this. We studied 1 Corinthians, and maybe you'll remember this, but Paul says, "Do you not know that the wicked will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither the sexually immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor male prostitutes, nor homosexual offenders, nor thieves, nor the greedy, nor drunkards, nor slanderers, nor swindlers will inherit the kingdom of God. And that is what some of you were. But you were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and by the Spirit of our God." Now, Paul didn't say, like we hear in the culture oftentimes, I'm sure you've heard this, once a homosexual, always a homosexual, right? We hear that. Paul didn't say that. He said, that's what some of you were, verse 11. So past tense. And so there is such a thing as an ex-homosexual. And the clear implication is that you aren't anymore because you were washed. And that's the first observation. What you were is not what you are. Sometime back, I had a conversation with someone who said something to this effect. You know, I spent several years as being drunk on the bottle, and so I'm an alcoholic. And I said, you were an alcoholic. You know, no, I am an alcoholic. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, he said. And I think some of us kind of are trained to think that way. We believe that. And but is that Bible? Is that Bible? And you can disagree with me. I'm just asking to be open-minded. What does the Bible say about that? Is that what the scriptures teach us about our identity? If I'm a Christian, is my present identity tied to my past sin? Is that what it teaches? Or is that what the world teaches, and then we just kind of absorb that from our surroundings? Now, my area is, and I don't even claim to be an expert in the Bible, but that's my area, is the Bible. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a professional counselor. I took some of those classes in college, and I have some experience with that. But I realize that that's not my area of expertise. And so this week, I sought out a PhD in psychology who owns a Christian counseling group. He's an expert in addictions. And I asked him about these things, also very, very serious about his faith and an elder in his church. And I wanted to see if my scriptural observations lined up with his extensive clinical observations. And here were the observations I presented to him. It seems to me alcoholism is a word that we've kind of invented to sort of take responsibility away from the chooser. The person who gets drunk. It's kind of a word that's meant to emphasize disease rather than choice. The Bible doesn't emphasize addiction, but rather choice, either to sin or to please God. And for that reason, we in the church should probably speak of the sin of drunkenness, because that's the biblical language, and maybe even consider discarding the language of alcoholism because of the connotation of disease. Because you hear people say, well, he's sick. He's got alcoholism. He's got a disease. And I think the Bible just says, no, he's choosing sin. And he may be in that habitual mode, right? But it's still a choice. And so, and then finally, the notion that someone who has habitually abused alcohol in the past can never again taste or even smell alcohol. I believe that mentality is itself a kind of bondage from which Christ set us free. And so, as I explained, you know, this is how I see it biblically. Help me, based on your clinical observations, tell me, am I wrong? Where am I wrong? And I really was fully prepared for him to say, no, Sean, you got to get out of your books and you got to go sit with people. I thought that's maybe what he would say. And he said, Sean, you actually, you're right. That's what I see. He told me a story of a couple who came to him because of the husband's misuse of alcohol and what it was doing to their marriage. And the husband, as this couple came into his office, the husband sat down and first thing he said was, now I've got to admit, I am an alcoholic. And his wife perked up and she said, no, you're not an alcoholic. You don't have a disease. You are making choices to get drunk. And the husband, to his credit, was humble enough to accept that correction. And it was freeing to him. And so this was his observation. And so here's my conclusion. A Christian who's been a drunk in the past, I think there's potentially more danger from wrong thinking than there is from a thimble of wine. We're not slaves to sin. So take this back now with me to the church in Corinth. The person who has abused sex, Paul calls him the sexually immoral. He's not going to inherit the kingdom of heaven, the person who's done that in the past. But he doesn't say you need to swear off from sex forever. No, it's, you know, you get within God's parameters and enjoy this the way that God outlined. The person who's abused money, Paul says they're greedy, they're swindlers, they're thieves. The idea isn't, well, they can never be trusted with money again. You make sure somebody else is in control of the pocketbook. No, it's you do this the right way. The person who's abused the tongue, Paul called them slanderers. This is what you used to be, slanderers. It's not that now they have to go mute. No, now you use your tongue to build others up rather than tear them down, you see? And the same thing with someone who's abused alcohol. Paul calls them drunkards. We need not swear off alcohol necessarily, though they may if they wish. And if they say, look, I just don't believe I can ever handle this without abusing it, then I think it's actually wise. And if they're convinced of that, that's a choice I support, certainly. But I don't know that it's necessary. They might also decide to partake within the limits. And I think it's very relevant to consider how Paul, knowing the Corinthian church had former drunks among them, and knowing how much he loved the people in Corinth, how passionately he cared for them, when this came up, the issue of abuse of alcohol actually in the Lord's Supper where they were getting drunk, he didn't write, are you people crazy? You're serving wine at the Lord's Supper? I mean, you have alcoholics among you. You need to serve grape juice or just take it away altogether. He didn't say that. Instead, he warned against excess and he told them to exercise self-control, which is one of the fruits of the Spirit. So as it pertains to the Lord's Supper, it's difficult for me as somebody who has abused alcohol in the past. I wish I could say I haven't. But it's difficult for me to imagine that this little, you know, maybe a fourth or an eighth of the alcohol content in a dose of cough syrup, that that's going to plunge somebody into, you know, just this helpless state of you know, alcohol abuse. I don't think that's a real risk. After I stopped drinking, I don't remember ever being presented with that as a difficulty for me personally. Now, I'll acknowledge there may be some risk for some people. And I would say if that's you, then you really should get help. And I don't mean that in a condescending way. If you have abused alcohol in the past and you say that little bit of wine, even in the Lord's Supper, something that Christ instituted for us, would cause me to then I would say, what will you do then if you get fired from your job and your car breaks down in front of the tavern? If that little thimble of wine amongst brothers would cause you to stumble, then we need to get you to a point where you could resist the bigger struggles. And I'll make myself available for you for that. I'll help hold you accountable. We'll grow you and get you ready for the bigger challenges that certainly lie ahead. So to wrap it up on that point, if that small taste of wine really is a serious risk to today's so-called alcoholics, then I really believe we could have expected Paul to show sensitivity to former drunks in Corinth and advise them not to partake in the communion wine, but instead he reminds them that Jesus commanded all to partake. Next one. What if someone's conscience doesn't allow him to consume alcohol? And that's a good question. Several people raised that. I was pleased that they cited Romans 14, and I don't know of a better chapter in the New Testament that helps us get to the heart of how we should relate to brothers who have differences. Romans 14 is very instructive there. But it's interesting that the Bible never relates the question of conscience to communion. Everyone was expected to participate in communion in the same way, in the same manner, personal convictions notwithstanding. And so it seems that Romans 14 is talking about relationships, not church policy regarding how the church celebrates this remembrance of Christ's death. The context there in Rome was you had Jews and Gentiles. I think for a while the Jews were kicked out of Rome and they came back, and now there are these, you know, two very different worlds. The Jews growing up and, you know, all the dietary laws and everything, and they're importing that into a situation where the Gentiles really can't relate to that. Okay, what do we do now? I think the point of Romans 14, because you see it three times, don't judge your brother. Don't judge your brother. Who are you to judge your brother? Before his own master, he stands or falls. Don't judge your brother. So I think that's the point. Judging versus accepting and loving and embracing people who have differences. I think that's what Romans 14 is about. And so Paul said that the personal decision whether to eat meat, this is a disputable matter. It's left to individual conscience. I think he would put drinking wine in there as well because he mentions it at the end of the chapter. And if someone's conscience does not allow him to eat meat sacrificed to an idol, we see this in 1 Corinthians 14, even though you probably shouldn't do that if you're actually in a pagan religious ceremony. But outside of that, you have that freedom. But what if that offends a brother? And Paul says, hey, in that case, I'll never eat meat again. I will sacrifice the freedoms that I have in Christ to accommodate a weaker brother. But what bearing does that have on the church practice? That's the question. Can someone's conscience overrule the words of Christ in the remembrance of his death? And what are the limits of conscience? For example, what if somebody said, and this may be difficult to imagine, but just hypothetically, what if somebody said, I have a conscience issue with baptism. I don't please don't ask me to go under the water. What would we do with that? Would we say, well, we'll respect that? What would we say? I think we would say your conscience is actually misinformed. You need to inform your conscience through the study of the Word. And that can happen. Consciences can change. And I'll offer a personal example. When I was younger, I grew up in a context where certain influences made me think that Sunday was the Sabbath day. And that I was obliged to keep the Sabbath, which was Sunday, instead of Saturday, which is really Saturday. And so I would feel guilty if I did work on a Sunday, which is really just not, there's nothing, no Bible to support that. But I would feel guilty if I did, at least if I did too much work, right? So I really can't sweep the garage, Mom. No. But And so what do you do with that? Well, Paul wrote this in Romans 14, but the man who has doubts is condemned if he eats because his eating is not from faith, and everything that does not come from faith is sin. And so I think I actually had a duty not to violate my conscience when I was under that impression. But I had an additional duty. In the same context, Paul writes this, each one should be fully convinced in his own mind. So we have a duty to continually inform our consciences based on the Word of God. And I think of Peter in Acts chapter 10. He had a similar experience, right? A very dramatic experience. He's laying there. The Lord appears to him in a vision. He says, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." Peter looks up and here are all these unclean animals. And Peter says, "Oh, no, Lord, surely not. I've never taken anything unclean into my body. I wouldn't do that. This is a conscience thing, Lord." And what did God say? "Oh, okay, well, never mind. I didn't realize he had a personal conviction." No, he's explaining. No, things have changed now. Okay, don't call anything unclean that the Lord has called clean. And so Peter now has an obligation to inform his conscience. And maybe it took him a little while. I don't know. But it's on the disputable matters, right, that conscience governs our behavior. It's not supposed to be on the revealed matters. It's on the disputable matters. Our consciences should not be separate, unaccountable kind of entities that are arbitrarily governing our behavior, untethered. That's not really what the Bible would teach about the conscience. Our consciences should grow and mature and take on increasing conformity to the Word. So on the Sabbath controversy, in time, I realized that just through studying the Word, that the Sabbath is actually Saturday, and that this is an old covenant thing, that I'm not obligated to keep the Sabbath anymore. And on this issue before us today, if you believe that Jesus drank wine, served wine, and instituted wine in the Lord's Supper, and yet your conscience won't allow you to follow that example, then I believe your conscience needs to change. And it can change. And I hope you're humble enough to receive that challenge from a brother who loves you. Number four, here's an objection that was came up a couple times. Symbols aren't important. It's what we're remembering that's really important. And I think that's kind of a false dilemma. I don't think it's either or. Either the symbols are important or what they're pointing to is important. I think they could both be important. I think it could be that the symbols are important because of what they're pointing to, you know, what they're rooted in. Give me an example. The U.S. flag, right? If somebody burns the flag, we don't say, "Well, it's not the flag that's important, it's the country. So that doesn't bother me. Ask a veteran." Okay? And if somebody lowers the flag and puts something else up instead, you know, your grandma's Afghan, might be a beautiful Afghan, but it's going to offend some people. And it's not just because, "Hey, I really love the red, white, and blue color scheme." It's because it's pointing to something really precious to them. Second, the idea that the symbol isn't important is never God's perspective in the Bible. He always seems to think that the symbols are highly important, and that's why he repeatedly said, according to, you know, temple worship and tabernacle worship, you got to do this exactly like I say, referencing those symbols. And third, I would say that I don't think any of us really believe that symbols aren't important. Now, you might think, "Oh, they're more important to you, Sean," but I think they're important to you too. I really do. If you came in here, let's say next around Easter time, and we're going to get, you know, we're going to celebrate communion together, and you came up there and you saw on the table those little marshmallow chicky things and bunnies and maybe some chocolate milk, and the marshmallows were to represent Christ's body and the chocolate milk was to represent his blood, I don't think you would say, "Oh, symbols aren't important." I think that would probably, most of you would be bothered by that. I don't even like those things, so I'd be doubly bothered. I think we would say this isn't fitting. It doesn't convey the respect, the seriousness. I think that's what we would probably all naturally say. So I think we all naturally attach some degree of significance to the symbols. If their purpose is to help us remember something very special, then the more fitting the symbol, the better. And finally, do you have anything else to say? Are you coming up here again? You're going to have to tell me when. Is it now? It is now, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Okay, right. Come on up here, Phil.
All right. The next one is...
We planned really well.
The next one is, could this cause division? And that thing's talking to me. Could this cause division? I'm just going to read, again, I love the heart behind this concern, this question. This is from John 17. The night before Jesus died, he prayed, "My prayer is not for them alone, not just for the 12. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you. May they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one. I in them and you in me, may they be brought to complete unity, to let the world know that you sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me." So Jesus' prayer is for unity in the church. Could this issue of communion, what we serve at communion, could it be a divisive issue? And the answer is, of course it could. Churches have divided over a lot less what kind of instruments are used for music. We could divide over Purdue and Ohio State, right? We could let that be a division. Does it need to cause division? You know, should it cause division? Will it cause division? That's I guess, the bigger question. Anything could cause division. Should it cause division? Will it cause division? And again, I want to say that this is something that it's really at the forefront of our mind, that this is not something we're, you know, ramrodding through, that, you know, we're going to insist this. Again, there's still some things to be ironed out. We want to bring everybody along. We're not, you know, kind of forcing this on anybody. We're open to those discussions, those challenges. If there are some remaining out there after this morning, we're willing to keep working through those. Certainly, the New Testament teaching is that we should function as a family, as one. We should display love and grace towards one another, again, as part of our witness to the watching world, that they may see that we're one, that they may see the love of Christ in us. So our hope and Jesus's hope, I think, is that this would not be a cause of division. I think Sean drew an important distinction there, that when there are disagreements within the body, when there are differences among brothers in Christ, I think, you know, when there's not a clear biblical mandate, when it's kind of in a gray area, then there's a lot of a grace to be extended. We're willing to give up our rights. We don't just have to, you know, have our way. We can compromise and accommodate one another, that kind of thing. When there is a biblical mandate, then I think that's something that we unite around, the biblical mandate. When there's a directive from God, I think that's something that we should unite around and not compromise on. And so I think, you know, we've tried to make the case that this is a biblical directive to take wine. Jesus said, "Take this, all of you, and drink from it." And so I think that is a clear biblical directive, that this is something that we're supposed to drink. And I think it was wine in the cup. And so I think it would have been dishonoring to Christ if Andrew or Bartholomew at that Last Supper had said, you know, "I'm going to pass for whatever reason." I think that would have been dishonoring to him, of them, if they had rejected what Jesus had offered. I also think that Jesus is, he's the Prince of Peace. He's gentle and tender, and he goes after that lost lamb. So I don't think, I'll say it this way. I'm patient because Christ has been patient with me. And this is something we want to continue to do. Again, extend grace to one another for those who aren't seeing it right away, or maybe won't see it this way for some time or ever. That's something we want to be, you know, very aware of and patient with. I'll say, if I use grape juice for every communion celebration from now till the day I die, I'm all right with that. I don't think it's ideal. I don't think it's what, you know, faithfulness to Christ looks like as we celebrate communion. I would never say that somebody who celebrates, somebody who's part of a different church or in this church doesn't see that the same way, that they're not a Christian or that they can't be, you know, maybe way ahead of me in a lot of other areas. But it would just be on that issue. I would think that's not what faithfulness to Christ looks like. So depending on, you know, again, how we iron out all these details, I think we need to determine, you know, that this is not going to divide us. We're going to be understanding with one another. We're not going to look down on one another. We're not going to get angry if we don't kind of get it our way, that kind of thing. But I do continue to think that this is a change that we should make. Again, there are some, it seems like, some exceptional cases for nursing moms and pregnant moms. And apparently there are people who are allergic to some of the parts of wine or whatever. So I think those are things that we'll again just need to iron out how we're going to handle those. And there are some different options that you can kind of think through what that might look like. And those are things we're just going to keep talking about, and we're open to your input on that. And I'll just close with my part with this, and Sean will come up and close the sermon time here. Communion should not cause division. It's actually a way of reinforcing our unity. It's something we do together as a family, remembering the sacrifice of Jesus by which we are brought together in the first place. It's a family meal in which we come with equal footing despite all of our differences. We take part in together, waiting for one another, and it looks ahead to the day when we will gather with believers of every tribe, language, nation, and tongue at the wedding supper of the Lamb and sing together in perfect harmony. So yes, communion ought to be always a reminder, a reinforcer of our unity, not a cause for disunity.
Last week I asked you to imagine being in the upper room, being, you know, someone that was there, an invited guest, and what would you have done when the cup came to you? I'd like to ask you to imagine what you're going to do on the day in the future in the kingdom, because Jesus said in Matthew, I tell you the truth, I will not drink again of the fruit of the vine until I drink it with you anew in the kingdom. He said with you. So the cup will come. It will be passed. And what are you going to do when that cup comes to you in the new kingdom? And I just, knowing my brothers and sisters here, I can't imagine anybody saying no thanks. And so a good question is, if I would take the cup then when it's passed to me, why wouldn't I take it now? And so just something to think about. Last kind of question or objection is what kind of message does this maybe send to the community? Would visitors or folks in the community, does it possibly damage our witness? And frankly, I just don't see that. I really don't. I think most people, you come into a Protestant, more or less evangelical Bible church, they're going to expect that you're going to use grape juice because that's just kind of the tradition. And if they say, well, I notice you use wine, you guys kind of part Catholic here? Could be an opportunity for us to say, no, you know, we used to use grape juice, but we have a conviction that, you know, that wasn't really ideal. It wasn't really in line with what the scriptures teach. And so we just decided to trust Jesus because that's how we do it here. And whether we're right or wrong, that just we believe that we needed to act on that. And so, yeah, it's a little bit of wine. It could be a teaching opportunity. Honestly, I don't think it's going to affect our witness. I really don't. I think, if anything, it could be a positive thing. But I want to close by reminding you that we really are still in the process here. Okay, it's not like, oh, it's week three, it's over, they've made up their minds. We still need to settle the question of who takes communion, like, you know, as far as kids, is that going to be reserved for baptized believers? We have other questions as well. You know, what about someone who might be on medication that can't mix with any amount of alcohol, even a tiny little bit, or pregnant moms or that kind of thing? Somebody who might have a wine allergy, what are we going to do about that? Are we going to offer an alternative? We're still talking about that. We're still in the process, not implementing any changes anytime soon. Thinking, talking, praying. I can tell you, I really have lost sleep on this because I love this church so much. I love the unity that we have as a body. And I've woke up in the middle of the night and many times, multiple times, just praying that God will protect our unity. And so I don't want anything to jeopardize that. And I trust you don't either. And so a great question would be for all of us, what do we do? What do we do if in the end it's not to our liking? Well, I can tell you I lived that way for, you know, at least 13 or 14 years. What do? You just keep having unity. And sometimes you say, you know what, it's really not about me. I'm part of this body. And so we're doing something together, and maybe not everybody's going to like it, but I'm going to set an example of love and unity. I'm certainly not going to gossip. That's not who we are as a Laetia. We're just not going to do that. No murmuring. I've had several conversations over the phone with brothers and sisters this week, exchanged emails and texts, and I've sat in homes. And I want you to know that I'm willing to do that more. I know the elders are. We're talking through this, and we're working through this together. We're patient. We're in this process. If you want to talk, let us know. We'll get together. And maybe if there's someone else who has the same concern, maybe we'll all get in the room and talk together. Fair enough? Let me close with a verse that Phil already referenced from Ephesians 4. And then Terry's going to come up and close us in prayer. Paul writes, "As a prisoner for the Lord, then, I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you have received. Be completely humble and gentle. Be patient, bearing with one another in love. Make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called to one hope when you were called. One Lord, one faith, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all."